We are continuing our journey through 1 Corinthians. We're in chapter 7. We're in kind of the middle of the chapter now, verses 10 through 24. You're missing 24 on your handouts because I forgot to put it there. So, this essay has to deal with men and women in the human family, and Paul has been progressing through different aspects of relationships between people and how the church ought to, how church and how their relationship with Jesus Christ and their theology about all of that has to inform relationships. And this is the last, really, the approaching the end of the second essay, and Paul is discussing, some practical examples of how theology plays out. This is applied theology within the human family. One of the main issue that Paul is dealing with is the problem of arrogance. That there are some who are saying this is the right way, and there's no discussion. In my way or the highway, basically. This has to do with some theological problems within the Corinthian church. They are holding to some theologies that are not found, that Paul sees as not Christian. One of this is the problem of the body-spirit or body-soul dualism, which derives from Greek philosophy, Greek theology. Pagan theology, where Christian theology follows the Jewish theology where the body is good. And in fact, there is no separation between body and spirit or body and soul. It's all one. You can't have one without the other. Second problem is the overemphasis on individual liberty. In Paul's mind, the liberty of individuals is not their liberty to do whatever they want, but rather it's the freedom to contribute to the community. Another problem is with the Corinthian believers, said, was with over-realized eschatology, which means basically that the fullness of the kingdom they believed had already come, and so they were incapable of sinning, they were no longer to marry, because Jesus in the Gospels is recorded as saying after the resurrection there will be no, like angels, that there will be no marriage.
So we're like angels now.
And so the Corinthian believers, that time had already come. And so they saw marriages as inferior, as something of the past life that they should get rid of. And Paul is saying, no, eschatology consists of the past, the present, and the future. The past is that the kingdom has come in part through the Spirit. The present is that we are living in that kingdom in part, but the fullness has not yet come. And finally, Paul's main point so far is that everything that Christians do, they need to do for the honor and glory of God. Last week we discussed two issues. Both related. One has to do with marriage, and the other with It was singleness. And Paul wrote against the underlying background for all of this appears to be the problem of asceticism. Again, it's the Corinthian believers were treating marriage as something to be less holy, to be removed from their midst. And so it looks like some were actively encouraging divorce. Paul is saying marriage is good. Sexual relations are a gift to one another. Men and women are equal partners in marriage. He also treated singleness and marriage both as types of spiritual gifts. Neither is better than the other. Both are good. And his point so far is to live and remain in the state you are gifted to be.
If you are gifted with a lot of hormones, get married. I think that's something not very many people talk about. Because those who have no hormones can lord it over those who do and say, you shouldn't do any of this. And it was actually happening right there then. You know, instead of realizing people are different, and for some people that would be fine, but for others it doesn't work.
Yeah, so we're going to discuss the next two items dealing with believers and unbelievers, basically mixed faith marriages. The second is the issue of Jew and Greek, slave and free. The first part goes from verses 10 through 16 of chapter 7. And so it reads, to the married, and the implication here is to the believing married. I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried. And this is the word agamos, which we saw earlier in this chapter, which means basically widow or widower. Someone who has been previously married, rather than someone who has never been married. So, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest, I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of or through and in his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner, and it is implied with desires to, but if the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved or bound. For God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save or keep your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save or keep your wife? And before we continue looking at this passage, this is a paragraph from the New International Commentary on the New Testament.
No, we're in these days, were they still making arranged marriages? In this context, would they hook them up with an unbeliever?
No, they would not hook up. It would be arranging with a believer with an unbeliever, but rather in the context in which this is occurring, it's when one partner becomes a Christian.
Like happens after the fact.
Yeah.
Right. Because it was a new thing.
It changed. Something changed.
Yeah. And so there were probably a lot of couples where one half believed.
And the commentary notes that Paul's response, along with that of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, has served as the basis for canon law in the church on the whole question of divorce and remarriage. But one must remember that the original intent of the passage was not to establish canon law, but to address a specific situation in Corinth, their apparent rejection of marriage on ascetic grounds. The text needs to be heard in its own historical context before it is applied to broader contexts. So, what Gordon Fee, the commentator, is saying is, well, this whole passage, this whole chapter has been often used as a code, canon law, basic church law, in regards to divorce and remarriage. And he's saying, well, that wasn't the original intent. And before we apply it in that context, we need to look at the historical context as to what it originally meant, what Paul intended. Mm-hmm. So believers and unbelievers, in regards to marriage, separation, and divorce, verses 10 and 11 are speaking to believers, believing married couples. So that's the ideal condition for married believers. So it is a directive. A directive is not a law. So it reads, to the believing married, I give this charge. So charge, even though Paul says it's not me giving this charge, but it comes from the Lord, it's less than the law. It sets forth an ideal. So, are these principles here that neither wife nor husband should initiate a divorce? Is that a broad principle applicable to all marriages between believers, or is it specific to just the Corinthian situation? And scholars are divided as to whether it is a broad principle applicable to all believers or not. Now, under Jewish law, women could not initiate divorce. But under Roman law, either party could. What is not under discussion, or there's no disagreement that the ideal is that there should be no divorce between married believers.
Right. Right.
But the reality is that divorce happens.
Mm-hmm.
And when it happens, it is not a moral failing. Paul concedes that it happens, and he doesn't condemn it. What Paul does write is, if a divorce happens, a marriage to a new partner appears to be proscribed. Is not allowed. Because, for one reason, is that it goes against the Jewish view of marriage as one flesh. When two people come together in marriage, they become one flesh, and until death do us part, basically. But in the more specific local context, if it was the women who were refusing sex to their husbands because it was supposedly more spiritual, and they were the ones, the women that were seeking divorce because the husbands were asking for sex, and the women were refusing it, and the women were getting tired of being asked for sex that they didn't want to give because it was more spiritual, and women wanted the divorce, then it would make no sense for the women to marry a new partner.
Well, no.
So that would be a specific case for the Corinthians why Paul would write something like this.
Divorcing for the purpose of setting yourself apart and being holy, then don't just use it as an excuse to go off and marry somebody new.
Right.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, but the husband may have a lot of reason to remarry.
The husband may. What Paul writes to then is the appropriate response here is reconciliation. No, if you're going to get remarried in order to have sex, you ought to reconcile.
Go back to your husband.
Yeah. And the broader kind of picture here is that if fractured relationships cannot be restored within Christian community, what does it say about Christianity? So that would be more of a general, broader principle that applies to all of Christianity, all believers. More specific thing is here is that asceticism within marriage was already condemned, so let the married repent of their aberrant theologies and reconcile. If divorce was occurring because of this specific reason that this aberrant theology that the Corinthians were following, then the appropriate response would be for the couples to repent and reconcile and come back together.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Huh. And so that's one reason why some scholars believe that the woman, the wife, is addressed first.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, oh, by the way, husbands should not seek divorce either. Uh-huh. And so the married state where both partners are believers is a good spiritual condition. That is Paul's affirmation. Uh-huh. Marriage is good. Uh-huh. And don't seek to change it. No, other states are not better. They're just different. And I would add here that what Paul is writing about seems to be about divorce based on self-indulgent reasons rather than upon need. So there are legitimate bases for divorce.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, he's not talking about that here at all.
No. So Paul is not saying believing couples should never divorce. After addressing believers, where both partners are believers, now he goes on to the case, the mixed faith marriage, believer-unbeliever marriages. And now Paul is saying these are his informed opinions. He's saying neither the Jewish scriptures nor Jesus has addressed this particular case.
I know the Lord.
The key comes in verse 14, where the unbelieving partner and the children, any children from this marriage, are made holy through the marriage. And another key is the last phrase of verse 15 where Paul writes, God has called you to peace. So we encounter two somewhat difficult ideas. That the unbeliever and children are made holy through the believer, and the very last part of this segment here where it says, you will save, that's how most translations read, you will save the unbelieving partner. So let's look at verses 12 and 13. But to the rest I say, I know the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. Paul is writing to the believing partner. And he is writing that the believer's preference should always be to marriage. Divorce is a last resort.
And probably especially to keeping the marriage that is already in place together.
Right. Mm-hmm. Remain as you are. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the central theme running through these sections. However, the unbelieving partner has the last word in relationship status. And it goes to the idea of maintaining peace.
Well, the unbelieving partner is the one that he doesn't have the authority to preach to. Mm-hmm. And so he's saying, if that person leaves, let him leave.
Well, and also they may not be able to handle
living
with someone who, especially someone who is converted to this way since they were married. That might not be okay.
And the priority is peace over maintaining a marriage. And once again, if we are talking about the context of asceticism here as well, then some may be saying that, some in the church is saying that mixed marriages contaminate the sanctity of marriage and the spirituality of the church.
Yeah.
And so they're encouraging divorce.
Encouraging them to divorce. Uh-huh. You're becoming unholy because of your unholy husband or something.
Right. Uh-huh. And note once again that Paul writes to both women and men as equals. So then we get to pair B, which is verse 14. Paul gives reasons why mixed marriages should remain as is. The center of this set of verses is on marriage and divorce, where this isn't key critical to interpreting it, but it's just interesting that Paul carefully crafts verse 14 in a very specific Hebrew poetic structure. So, verse 14 reads, made holy, unbelieving, believing, in the first pair, and made holy, unbelieving, believing, in the second pair. And it also follows, within that is a ring composition of husband, wife, wife, husband, in which they're kind of... So, Paul... What we do understand from that is that 14 is important. Verse 14 is very important. Otherwise, Paul would not have so carefully considered the rhetorical form. Then we come to the issue of holiness, defilement, and the idea of clean and unclean. Purity laws generally held that the clean would become defiled when clean came into contact with the unclean. And we know that from the Old Testament. The Jews were very concerned about purity, being clean.
Touching anything unclean.
And clean and holy, although they're not identical, they are very closely associated. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some few Old Testament texts that show that holiness can be transmitted to make the common holy. Especially in, Ezekiel, I think. Was it Ezekiel?
Interesting.
In the vision of the temple that was supposed to be rebuilt.
Making common things holy.
Yeah. There's instructions for the priests in both, the Torah as well as the prophets that say you have to be careful about how you treat the holy coming into contact with the common, because if the holy comes into contact with the common becomes holy and now it won't be able to go outside the sanctuary.
I see. Rather than the holy becoming defiled.
Right.
Huh. Interesting. Okay.
What we see in the gospel accounts is that Jesus disregarded those purity laws. completely intelligent. What it does, what it did show is that Jesus, being the ultimate holy being, could touch anything. Uh-huh. And it made the unclean clean.
Uh-huh. Rather than Jesus becoming defiled by touching unclean things, he made everything holy.
Right.
The Old Testament, they haven't invented soap yet.
Yeah, some of these things made sense.
I didn't
do it because they heard it.
Maybe. But did they commonly use soap?
It was a rich person's thing.
Yeah, probably.
Back in those days, you only rinsed with water.
Yeah.
And they certainly didn't have disinfectant.
Right, not antibacterial soap.
So some of that made sense, yes. But when you're overemphasizing the purity and the ritual of it.
So what does that have to do with mixed marriages? Well, this is the problem Corinthians had. Some Corinthian believers had with mixed marriages. Since sexual relations cause two bodies to become one, referring back to chapter 6, what is this body? This body, is it going to become clean or unclean? Holy or unholy? That's their concern. And because the unbelieving partner inevitably is performing pagan practices, immorality, isn't having sexual relations with the unbeliever same as committing sexual immorality? And didn't Paul command believers to flee from sexual immorality? Chapter 6, verses 13 and 18.
Mm-hmm. There's probably all sorts of uncleanness going on.
So the Corinthians have some logic behind their reasoning. Paul's response is that Christ's holiness is more powerful than paganism. That's why he writes verse 14 the way he does. The single body of marriage is made holy because of the believing partner. And because of that, the children of a holy marriage is also clean and holy. This clean and this holy has nothing to do with salvation. It has to do with the immediate concern of the Corinthians in regards to religious and ritual defilement.
So he's not saying that the personal salvation of the unbelieving partner will be imparted by the marriage.
Now, some scholars do disagree. What does Paul intend by holy? Or Walter thinks it does mean salvation. In that case, Paul is presenting a very radical vision of an avenue to salvation.
Uh-huh. Becoming saved by marrying someone who is without any...
I don't think this person's opinion. Since it's a personal relationship required.
Yeah. No,
and each person is held accountable.
Uh-huh. Well, the way I've always seen it is being married to someone who has a relationship with God will cause that to happen.
Will influence.
Yeah.
Well, influence.
Well, yeah, but they have to choose that.
Yes.
Right.
But, they're still...
Well, it kind of does.
It's not just osmosis.
If that person...
There's osmosis, but there's also a personal choice.
If that person chooses not to leave that relationship, it may be kind of inevitable.
It may well happen.
If you, and that's why I've always told the kids.
If you choose to stay in a relationship, then...
If you choose to stay in school through high school, it's not obligatory that you learn anything, but it's inevitable that you will. If you choose to stay in school, it's not your responsibility to learn, it's the teacher's responsibility to teach. You will learn.
It's your responsibility to stay there.
Right.
I don't know.
But
I don't know. I kind of see it as
that people stay in marriages but completely rebel
I still think it's the student's responsibility to learn.
The spouse's belief and even the abuse of it.
Yeah.
And not ever come around.
Well, I think this may be worthy of a couple weeks or decades of studying, because the Old Testament is rife with contamination of good from bad.
Yes.
And that's what the whole Jewish life was all about, is keeping the pure. And they were trying to separate themselves. That's the whole history of the Old Testament.
Yeah,
you're right. In
ways, Jesus preached that they were wrong in trying to completely separate themselves. They need to be a witness.
Right. So, but the Old Testament is rife with good being contaminated with bad. But you're right that Jesus' whole life was just the opposite, is that he did not disassociate from bad. He always influenced bad with good. So, actually, from that perspective, he is a reverse of that. But then if you go down to Revelation, which is the heart of the Seventh Adventist beliefs, is come out of her, my people. We have to separate. We are the chosen. We are the separate. We are the special.
You have to go both ways.
But that isn't really what Jesus did. Jesus didn't separate.
Well, no, and I wasn't saying that the unbelieving spouse is going to cause you to unbelieve either.
No.
It isn't necessarily going to be peaceful.
It's about staying away from both extremes.
Yeah.
Don't completely isolate yourself so that you don't have influence, but don't go into the world either.
Well, I have a sneaking notion that there's a lot more depth to this than we can.
Well, Gordon Fee, which is the contributor to the New International Commentary of the New Testament for this 1 Corinthians, presents a different solution as to the meaning of holy. The key he sees is in Romans chapter 11, verse 16, which reads, "If the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches." This chapter 11 is part of a parable of Jews rejecting Jesus and Gentiles grafted in as a result of that rejection. But Paul's concern is still with the Jews. What happens to the Jews? Holy is not the same as saved in Romans 11. But holy does mean set apart.
That makes sense.
Although the Jews rejected Jesus, they are still set apart. Mm-hmm. That part has not changed.
They're still holy?
They're still holy. A few did believe. They're the first fruits. And their faith makes the entirety of Jews holy and in a special relationship with God, though not salvific. In other words, doesn't confer salvation.
They don't have to be.
But the first fruits make the entire Jewish people set apart in a special way.
So in other words, he's saying whether or not the unbelieving partner develops a personal relationship with Jesus, the union has been made holy.
Right. So likewise, the believing spouse changes the dynamic through which God is able to work with the unbelieving spouse and the children of the marriage. They are made holy in this sense. And in a different commentary, Understanding the Bible Commentary, the author there writes, through the believing partner, the marriage between a pagan and a Christian is withdrawn from the control of the powers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
In living together with the world, the saints are the stronger party.
God now has a hand in marriage.
The decisive idea lies not in an ontological definition of the state of the non-Christian members of the family, but in the assertion that no alien power plays any part in the Christians dealing with them.
Well, I think part of the problem is we are trying to anchor that my personal salvation is the most important point there is, and everything has to rotate around that. And I don't necessarily think that we have a correct understanding of what that salvation is. And it is, if salvation was the most important point there was, Jesus gave it up for something better because he left heaven and came here. So I kind of agree with you in that there's a different definition of saved than we're were historically, culturally programmed.
Yeah. We need to also remind ourselves and understand that in the New Testament, where there are some convergence stories of entire households being saved by the decision of the head of the household.
Mm-hmm. And we always dismiss all that, but I think there's more to it than we know.
No, the father or sometimes the head was the woman. Did not ask their family members, their servants, their slaves, whether they wanted to become Christians or not. They made the decisions for them. And the household was considered saved.
And nowadays, you occasionally see an entire church doing that. The pastor converts to a different religion, and the church goes with them.
And then the whole church is allowed to park in our parking lot. And that can go for a nation. I think the United States has been blessed for centuries for certain reasons. But
right.
I think there's a lot more depth to this than we in our intelligence can fathom.
So we get to the last two verses of this section. But if the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. Brother and sister meaning the believing partner. Mm-hmm. For God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Paul is writing, believers hold to a higher ideal than that of non-believers. Therefore, the believing partner ought to always prefer remaining married. However, the unbelieving partner is not bound by the Christian ideal. He or she may request divorce. I think it's an important principle with wide-ranging applications outside of this specific example. Believers cannot hold unbelievers to Christian standards.
I think that point needs to be emphasized in today's society as well. That believers need to stop trying to hold unbelievers to their standards, to a particular set of rules.
How does that work in a marriage, though, when you're trying to raise kids a certain way, or raise kids, period, and you need to be on the same page? I can understand it like general society, but within a marriage, you need to be somewhat on the same page. A lot of
things. In a marriage, I think it's a lot more difficult. In a marriage, it can be very difficult if the two people don't agree.
Yeah,
on
there's
some things.
Yesterday, I listened to a short presentation by a Christian woman who is married to a husband who began as a Christian marriage, but he deconverted, became an atheist. Uh-huh. They have children.
So what are they?
Deconverted.
Deconverted.
Deconverted. That's the new word.
Yeah. Basically, they tell their children both sides, uh-huh, and let their children make the choice.
Uh-huh. So what if one person doesn't have any specific anything that they stand for or don't stand for, and the other one does? How do you explain that? It's like I can understand, uh-huh, like if one is firm atheist and one is firm Christian, okay, yeah, this is what daddy believes, this is what mommy believes.
Then you would raise the children.
Mommy believes something and daddy doesn't really
then
have
most
a firm
likely
set of
you would
beliefs
raise the children in mom's beliefs and explain to them as they get older the difference.
Yeah. And that other person has to be supportive of that too.
Yeah. And that,
undermine it.
I don't know.
You would just tell them.
Keep your mouth shut at least.
One of the parents isn't very enthusiastic about it, but they support it.
If, assuming they do support it.
Well, yeah,
right,
but
yeah.
I mean, if they don't, sometimes they, run their mouth and they're
lying. I don't think that's what Paul said. I think Paul kept coming back is the believing person has the higher road of peace.
Right.
Peace is the overarching principle.
And therefore, the higher road is to let go of that high standard for the sake of peace, because peace is more important than the high road.
Yeah, and what this woman, this lady, said is, you know, sometimes her kids go to church, sometimes they don't. She thinks, or she, the one of them has told her that, no, he probably doesn't believe. And she's okay with that.
That would be hard. That would be really hard. And that's one reason that it tends to work a lot better if both people agree on some basic issues. A marriage is a lot easier. But you can work it out.
Yeah. She would like her husband to reconvert, not because of salvation issues. That's not her reason at all. It's because it will make life easier, especially around holidays.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people
peaceful with the
family and
friends. There's a lot of traditions that are religious in nature that would make
but
it a lot easier.
If you have left Christianity intentionally, then you might choose to leave the traditions that come from Christianity too.
More than half of Christmas is traditional and social.
Yeah. But the idea that, back to the idea that a believer can't impose their beliefs on the people around them, that is big in today's world. You see a lot of attempts at that.
Right. I think it goes both ways, though, too. Yeah. If he doesn't want to celebrate Christmas, don't celebrate Christmas, but don't make it so the rest of us can't.
Right. But like the other day, we heard about a judge who made a family change their baby's name because they named the baby Messiah.
Yeah.
And the judge said, that is a title. Only one person has earned that title, and you can't use it.
They get it, but
can the judge say that?
No.
If he was,
I would say he can only say that if that title has been
legally defined.
Right. Copyrighted.
Right. But there isn't any such thing.
Right.
In my mind, the judge cannot say that.
No. But no, Paul says
the judge, name on his birth certificate.
The judge is not a religious authority. He can only say that if it's been copyrighted through the government.
Paul said that if a non-Christian disputed the naming of their child Messiah, the Christian spouse should defer and agree with the non-Christian's viewpoint. Paul said the Christian should defer to the non-Christian.
Okay. Pretty much.
When it comes to divorce.
Well,
I don't know. That's not what he said. He says in the marriage, he has to defer to peace. In the marriage.
Mm-hmm. And I think in everyday life, sometimes you would need to defer for peace. And sometimes there may be things.
Moral issue, though.
Yeah, sometimes there might be things where you need to stand up and say.
You can stand for your ideals, but you cannot impose your ideals.
No, but you could stand and say, "This is what I am going to do." As for
me and my house, don't think about that one.
But when the house is divided, you can't say me and my house.
Just for me, myself, and I.
You can say for me.
The house divided can't stand.
That's true.
Well, but as for naming the children, I don't think it would be a good idea to try to give the child a religious name that one parent disagrees with. I think that would be.
I think that all names should be agreed on anyway, regardless of your religious beliefs.
Regardless of why you're disagreeing.
In my family, one person doesn't just get to pick the name. I can't do that.
In our family, we chose the first names together. And we agreed on the first names. And we got the names from from Mark's mom without any reservation of veto rights, and we said that's her choice, and we were fine with that, and we liked the ones she chose. But that was our decision,
right?
Mm-hmm. So
So the believer's priority is not to enforce his or her beliefs upon the unbeliever, but to maintain peace.
Yeah.
Culturally, that position is not in vogue.
Culturally, a lot of believers do try to.
Believers have a responsibility to respect the unbeliever's desires.
Yeah.
And so far, Paul's statements are fairly clear, but then he writes, in such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved or bound. What exactly does Paul mean? Well, some think this means remarriage is allowed to the believer for this specific case.
When the divorcing spouse is an unbeliever.
When the divorce occurs because of belief system conflict. Gordon Fee sees the binding in regards to the ideal to maintain the marriage. In other words, in this particular case, the Christian partner is no longer bound to the ideal of remaining married, so divorce is allowable. Mm-hmm. Gordon Fee also writes that nowhere in these passages is remarriage a concern of Paul. Paul is simply not addressing that issue at all. Mm-hmm. So to use these texts to either allow or disallow remarriages is a misuse.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And he writes, our situation is usually much more complex because our concerns are often the precise opposite of theirs, speaking of the Corinthians, which caused this to be written in the first place. They wanted to dissolve marriages. We want to know whether remarriage is permitted.
Uh-huh.
Paul does not speak to the question of remarriage. If that is one's concern, then it must be wrestled with in the much larger context of Scripture, and the answer is not clear-cut. In many cases, such marriages are clearly redemptive. Even if it is not the ideal situation, God still redeems our fallenness, whether it be individuals or broken marriages. On the other hand, there is nothing redemptive in remarriage that is simply an excuse for legalized lust.
Yeah. Or for leaving your faithful partner. An excuse for leaving your faithful partner.
So you're saying that Corinthians was totally written regarding asceticism?
That is Gordon Fee's position.
So it's nonsensical to even talk about remarriage because their whole purpose was to get divorced.
Yeah.
Their whole purpose was to not have sex.
And finally,
remarriage wouldn't be an issue.
Finally, one of the most the other confusing statement: you will save your partner. What exactly is Paul's intent?
Maybe.
Right.
Well, yeah. I've always heard it explained that maybe your partner will come to a saving relationship with Christ.
It's one of the more difficult passages. Mm-hmm. And there's no clear-cut explanation. The majority view seems to be that believing partners should not seek a change in status, in other words, remain as you are, remain married, because mixed marriages may lead to the salvation of the as-yet unbelieving family members, whether they be the unbelieving spouse or the children of such marriages. Ken Bailey suggests that Paul simply meant keep the marriage. Take the most obvious reading, because only God can save a person. The believing partner's high view of marriage and his or her desire to maintain peace might be enough to keep to save the marriage in its most literal sense.
Save the marriage.
Yeah. Rather than save the person.
As in keep the spouse.
Yeah. There's no definitive explanation as to what exactly Paul meant. Then we get to the next section. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 17 to 24. Only let each person lead the life the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. An alternate reading is A more literal reading is to each as the Lord assigned. And this word assigned is merizo, meaning, which can also mean distributed, which has the sense of the distribution of spiritual gifts. And to each as God has called, let them walk. This is my directive in all the churches. Verse 18, was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. Some Jews, apparently actually Jewish males, apparently actually sought to remove the marks of circumcision, or at least hide them.
Surgery.
Apparently there was a painful procedure that could get that done so that when they went to bathe in public baths, you know, at casual glance, they would would appear uncircumcised.
Yeah.
Verse 19, for neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. A more literal reading is, for circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing but keeping the commandments of God. Verse 20, each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. A more literal reading here is, everyone in the calling into which he was called should remain. Verse 21, were you a bondservant when called? Or were you called while a slave? Don't be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a bondservant is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a bondservant of Christ. Freedman is different from free man. Freedman is someone who used to be a slave and was freed. A free man is someone who has never been a slave. So, a more literal reading of 22 is, for the person in the Lord called a slave is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is called free is a slave of Christ. 23, you were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants or slaves of men.
In 23, James used the word freeman.
Oh, freeman?
Yeah.
Maybe the translators didn't quite understand the difference.
And 24, so brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God. Whatever condition is inserted by translators. A literal translation is, everyone in that which he was called, brethren, let him remain with God.
In other words, be who you are.
So, this section deals with Jew and Greek, slave and free, remain in your calling. Why does Paul suddenly introduce a topic of ethnicity and social class into a discussion dominated by marriage and sex? Galatians 3:28 is the explanation that commentators provide as to why Paul inserts this discussion. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's the set of three. Mm-hmm. Paul has been discussing the male and female issue. And for completeness sake, he adds the Jew and Greek, slave and free. By doing so, Paul extends the theme of remain as you are beyond male-female, beyond the marriage issue. Then we have to ask, is Paul discussing socioeconomic and ethnic status? In other words, be content with whatever lot life has dealt you. Or is he discussing God's calling? Don't seek a different assignment or calling. Both readings are possible, and scholars are quite divided on the issue. It certainly is true that Christians can and ought to live spirit-led lives regardless of situation, regardless of condition.
Well, he doesn't actually say you should remain a slave if you are. He says if you can gain your freedom, do it.
It sounds to me like he's saying, don't go to your master and say, because I've become a Christian, you have to release.
I'm not a slave to you anymore. Right. I'm an individual with freedom.
Yeah. So in the set of commentaries, I use about four main ones. The UBC and the New International Commentary fall into the status side. So those commentaries assume that Paul is talking about the status, the condition. Whereas Bailey, in reading the New Testament, prefer the calling. It's about God's assignment and God's calling. The Greek words are, in this passage, it's consistently called and calling. It's not about status or condition. And notice that translations may change one of them to like condition, or can't remember what that was. Verse 20. Each one should remain in the condition or calling. Literally, it is calling. And verse 24, translations may insert whatever condition. Let's first deal with the easier thing, the issue of circumcision. First, the Corinthians weren't terribly concerned about like the Galatians were. Now, Paul doesn't really deal with the issue of circumcision. He just mentions it here. So this is a further illustration outside of male, female, the marriage issue that also touches on status as it and how it doesn't relate to whether one is spiritual or not. For Jews, circumcision was a serious issue. It was the identifying mark of whether or not one belonged to the right spiritual group. The group, are you in the covenant or not? If anything should qualify as separating the spiritual haves from the have-nots, it should be circumcision. Paul introduces that as the prime example of status that doesn't matter. So what matters? Paul writes, it's keeping the commandments of God. Well, that opens up a whole can of worms, at least for modern readers. But what is it? Well, in the context of 1 Corinthians, it's probably chapter 13, love. And in the context of this immediate chapter, it's about following God's assignment and calling that is unique to each person. In other words, be true to yourself as God has called you and gifted you. Then we get to the second part of this passage. Is Paul really saying he isn't really concerned about slavery? Is Paul really only concerned with just the spiritual condition of each person? Again, scholars are rather divided on the interpretation of this. Some think Paul isn't really concerned because of his eschatological views. In other words, the end of the current order is near, so why fight for social change? Or because the history of slave rebellion has been brutal, bloody, and unsuccessful, why encourage actions doomed to failure? Now, Paul's being pragmatic. At least that's one interpretation that could be given. We also see slavery through Western modernist eyes. Perhaps the ancients didn't consider slavery to be the evil that we do today. Perhaps Paul was concerned with maintaining societal order, as is suggested by some of his earlier writing in this letter.
Live in the culture that you're in.
Yeah. Or perhaps Paul doesn't have in mind the social context of slavery at all, as he writes about this topic. And this is from New International Commentary again. This imagery, of course, must be understood in light of Greco-Roman slavery, not that of recent American history. Slavery was, in fact, the bottom rung on the social order, but for the most part, it provided generally well for up to one-third of the population in a city like Corinth or Rome. The slave had considerable freedom and very often experienced mutual benefit along with the master. The owner received the benefit of the slave's services, and the slave had steady employment, including having all his or her basic needs met. Indeed, for me to be a slave was preferable to being a freedman, whose securities were often tenuous at best. But the one thing that marked the slave was that, in the final analysis, he did not belong to himself but to another. And that is Paul's point with this imagery.
Well, what about something like our modern military? When you commit yourself to the military, you are committing to doing as you're told, and in some way not really belonging to yourself. I mean, you have freedom to follow a religion, but in a lot of other ways, you belong to someone else.
In some contexts, person in the military is deemed to be owned by the government.
When they had the draft, you did not lose a lot of your personal rights, but when you volunteer, you do.
When you volunteer, yeah.
When you volunteer, you do lose a lot of personal rights.
So how might another culture look at that?
It changes with time.
If there's another culture that doesn't have that kind of military service, might they look at us the same way we look at someone who keeps slaves?
We look at an employer-employee relationship as wonderful, but the fact that the employee has no medical benefits and is a sharecropper, dirt poor, we overlook that. Other times and eras will look back on us with pretty sad.
Well, yeah, somebody working at McDonald's who is on minimum wage and has no security. How would that be different? How would that be better than a Roman slave who had security and wealth?
No income.
But no income.
Come back a couple hundred years from now.
But they didn't have income, but they had everything that income would provide.
Yeah. They didn't have personal freedom, but they had a trustworthy master and a good relationship. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, not in all cases, but in some cases. Yeah. How, it's kind of odd that we say slavery in itself is horrible and awful, but then a lot of our own practices, well, I'm not saying slavery is good.
Because as far as we've ever seen, slavery is always enforced by violence. And in Roman society, that wasn't necessarily the case. It was sometimes voluntary.
Mm-hmm. True. But anyway, it's interesting.
A third view, Ken Bailey suggests a third view here. First, there was very little Paul could do publicly against slavery.
Yeah.
And second, it is one thing to speak privately among believers against slavery.
Uh-huh.
It can be likened to Christians who lived under Stalinist Russia, who had to be very careful about what they said in public and wrote down that could be used against them.
Uh-huh.
So it's not about cowardice, but prudence.
Yeah.
In a letter that Paul is carefully writing, he has to be careful about what he writes against the empire. Whereas when he's speaking among believers, he's far freer to say what he believes.
And he might say, those of you who own slaves, he might encourage them to give their slaves their freedom. But when writing a letter and talking to slaves themselves, would he say publicly and recorded down?
In the one case, one example that's left to us, in the letter to Philemon,
uh-huh.
Paul writes to Onesimus. Onesimus is the slave. Philemon is the
person he's writing.
Yeah, to writing to. So he basically, without coming right out and saying, "Free Onesimus because I need him," he comes as close as he can get mm-hmm. without saying those exact words.
Yeah.
Because they were both believers. So this is what Ken Bailey writes. In the first century, preaching in the catacombs by the light of an oil lamp was one thing. There they could speak freely. Circulating a written document was something else. Into whose hands might it fall? Paul could not, in writing, attack the institution of slavery and survive. In this critical passage, Paul pushes the envelope as far as he can. In effect, he says, if you are caught in slavery, try to get free. If you are free, do not become a slave. Yet, if you are caught in this horrible institution, you can yet find and carry out an assignment. You can exercise your gifts and respond to your call. If you are a slave, do not look wistfully at me with my freedom and the privileges of Roman citizenship and say, of course the Lord can use him, but I am a slave. I can do nothing. Don't forget your calling and never imagine that there is no calling for you because you are a slave.
Yeah. To try and say that Paul is supporting slavery is absurd. Especially in the context in which he lived. I mean, slavery was different then, of course. But also, it would be dangerous enough for him to say otherwise in the letter. That to try and say those were his true feelings all the time is absurd.
Yeah. So what's Paul telling the Corinthians here in this section? Status does not affect your ability to live as a Christian, which is to carry out God's assignment according to His call and gifting to you. Don't seek a change in status as a means of improving spiritual condition. Don't use status or the lack of privilege as an excuse to not carry out God's assignment. And if you're given the opportunity to improve your lot, do so. Live your calling, not someone else's. And don't force your calling onto someone else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a few summary thoughts here at the end. Single versus married is irrelevant to one's call and gifting. Mm-hmm. Christians can live out their calling even if their partner is not a believer. Religious status is irrelevant to God's call. Socioeconomic status is irrelevant to God's call. What matters is faithfulness to remaining in God by being true to God's call for you and only you. The Corinthians apparently had this vision that following God looked exactly like this and that everyone should conform to it.
What a novel idea.
Paul is writing, no, God's calling can happen wherever you are. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't use your condition as an excuse to not follow God.
And his calling is different for each person. Mm-hmm.